Good evening. Welcome to tonight's event, 30 Years Under the Influence, St. George's Tale of Liquid Courage, presented by Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. You can find them online at commonwealthclub.org, Inforum, and you can follow the best of the Inforum dialogue on Twitter from their handle at InforumSF. Bob Klein, co-proprietor of Olivetta Restaurant, across the water there in Oakland. And tonight we're celebrating three decades of St. George Spirit success with founder York Ruff. Master distiller Lance Winters. And this distiller Dave Smith.
All right.
So last week when Jorg and I had lunch to try to come up with a plan for this, it was a great time. We had a good time. And we talked about all the things that had sort of become, that had started here over the last 30 years. It's a really impressive list. The latest is Spirits. Spirits is a major, important movement that's sort of spreading across the country. If you look back over the last 30 years, the lineup would include a revolution in farming and organic produce, coffee, wines, lots of different foods, numerous technologies. And we talked about common elements in those things, things like vision, focus, developing a market, talent. And we talked about shared values in those advances also, things like craft, genuineness, integrity, spontaneity, depth, anti-industrial, handmade. And we thought that this might be a good organizing theme for tonight, along with telling some good stories. They're very good storytellers. So spirits is a different, spirits and a different kind of cocktail have, cocktails have changed a lot over the last 30 years. And they're really happening, and St. George Spirits has been at the center of it. So that's an honor for us to sort of be at the center of the story, what I think has been a really substantial movement. George, is that about what we talked about?
How can I remember? It was last week.
Yes, it seems very good.
So do you want to start with old days?
Old days, I talked a little bit about it earlier, but I want to just say the old days were the crazy days. The crazy days were when there was no industry here, no spirits to be consumed. Most restaurants didn't even have a spirits license, or if they did, it was like white wine and cheese. For cocktails, it was not a good time in the early 80s to try to introduce something as far removed from our imagery here as an after-dinner drink, even, let alone something, the spirit itself. So,
So I remember we used to have, you know, like if you'd go to a restaurant, if you drank, and of course, people like us didn't have cocktails. It would be like Cutty Sark and Royal something.
Yeah.
And then we got really interested in wine, and I remember you showed up with some eau de vie, this is a long time ago, and Maggie was really fascinated with it, but didn't really know what to do with it. And we didn't even know if we could serve it. We didn't know if it was like bona fide spirits or not. So, and it didn't matter because we couldn't order, nobody would order it anyway.
Yeah.
So how did you get through that?
Well, with persistence, I'd say. I thought that it is a wonderful thing. I was really enthused by the idea of bringing an old European culinary tradition to this country, and I was encouraged by the growing interest in quality wines. When I first came here, most restaurants had as their wine list a little table tent that included three choices. The top choice was Chablis, the middle choice was Rosé, and the bottom choice was Hardy Burgundy, all made by a small winery called E&J Gallo.
Yeah.
That was a very common wine list, and I then was no longer surprised to see that people would order coffee with dinner. I had actually never seen this before in my whole life,
yeah.
But the positive was you could actually see through the coffee to the bottom of the cup.
So it was okay.
So it was, in that way, was okay, and it seemed to be replenished all the time. So coming from that place, it was really fascinating to me to see Pete started, I guess, at that point, too. It wasn't only the wine industry. There was the whole culinary scene was propulsion in it. I have to also say what really intrigued me further was to see the flexibility and openness of people here, how fast they actually took to drinking better stuff. And I thought the same thing's going to happen with spirits. Nobody knows anything about after-dinner drinks, but they will soon. Well, it took a little longer, but, it took a while. But good things sometimes take a while.
Yeah. What drove you? I mean, why would you be
Why would I be so crazy? Because I wanted to do it. I was a lawyer before, and I don't want to insult anybody who has this profession.
It's okay.
I didn't know you were a lawyer.
I can. It just didn't satisfy me. It was too much paperwork, not enough personal involvement. I wanted to do something for myself that really fed me. And I wanted to have, at the end of the day, not a piece of paper in my hand, but something that I made. That really drove me. And it was something I could do all by myself. Plus, it was bringing if I wanted to think grandiose, bringing a European culinary tradition here. So all of this together, but it was really the bottom line was me and my stubbornness.
Yeah. So how long did that go on for?
Well, would say it went on for quite some years. In the first year, I sold 40 cases. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
And
is that your best year?
To date.
The distribution turned out to be a problem, especially since I'm not a really good salesman. But I also, from what you said, the start was I would go to places like Campton Place, most of you guys know as a very well-situated and renowned restaurant in the city, and it was probably 83, I'd guess. And I talked with a bartender. They had a bar. Most people didn't. And told him about what I was making, showed him my bottle. And he said, oh, very interesting, very interesting. But I could tell he had no idea what I was talking about. But at some point he said, oh, I think I got it. And he got up in the back room and came back a few minutes later with a bottle of French Poir William in his hands. And I said, that's it. That's exactly what I'm making now here locally. Isn't that exciting? He said, yeah, it excites me because I really want to support local products. On the other hand, I have to tell you, I've had this bottle, which was half full, for over 3 years in my back room. So I don't know when I'm going to be ready to order anything from you. Really, the biggest jump came from an unexpected source that was both unexpected and very satisfying, because at the end of the 80s, through my efforts to connect with the European market, somebody entered some of the product in a very prestigious European competition in Austria, and we won first prize with the Pierrot de Vie. And when I followed this up with a visit over there, I started to find an importer and sold a multitude of what I sold in this country over there. So that helped us.
So you were making all this eau de vie and had it kind of, you're holding on to it. You didn't have anything to do with it. All of a sudden you could...
I'm a simple mind, you know, one-track mind. I could have probably expanded, but also... In all truth, there wasn't really a market for any of the cocktail items that we make now. There was not really a gin market. And the vodka market at that point was so low priced with our methods, there was no way to get into it.
Yeah.
So it was a real bind to overcome. But then in the 90s, things changed. And, of course, the biggest change for St. George Spirits came when Lance with his crazy ideas came too, because one thing I found in this kind of enterprise, if you do something that's totally out of whack and you have some ideas behind it, you attract like-minded people.
All the nut jobs show up at your door.
They show up. And, you know, every time I would tell people, well, you know, this is all nice and good, you really want to do this, but, you know, the money side is not that satisfying. Everybody would say, you know, we'll deal with the money when we deal with the money. And this was true for Lance, too, who, by the way, is so modest. He came through the door. He was in the brewing industry. And, of course, all brewers, as I know from my family, because my family had a brewery and I didn't want to brew. I wanted to distill. He came in with a bottle of whiskey in hand, already made, and showed his license to be a master in that way.
Where'd you buy that?
I think that the statute of limitations on moonshining is 7 years. I'm hoping that is. Carolyn, can you look that up for me? I made it in my garage and brought it in to have Jorg try it, and this is where I was introduced to Jorg's standards. I poured a glass, and Jorg smelled it, and said, it's got some good oak to it, tasted it, and he said, it's inoffensive.
Turns out that's high praise.
It turns out that's very high praise. Jorg is very metered with his praise for things, and that's part of the secret to the success here. When you come to this country with an idea it's got a great cultural basis to it, but it doesn't have any history in this country, you have to do it better than anybody else to really be able to gain any traction. And that's what he did. And I think one of the other things, and I'm not modest. You're modest. I'm a fathead. You're modest. one of the many things that Jorg is going to be modest about is the fact that he understood something at this very basic level about creating an industry for eau de vie in this country. And that was that one man is not an industry. And what he wanted to do was be able to teach more people about making eau de vies. And so he went out and trained Randall Graham and his distillers and taught them how to do this. Another crazy artistic fella. He went up to Clear Creek and showed Steve McCarthy how to distill eau de vies. He went out to the East Coast to show Lou and Margaret Chady at Westford Hill Distillers. The list goes on and on, to the point where Jorg has been called throughout the industry the godfather of the artisan distillation movement. And it's not an exaggeration at all. It's definitely what you've done. And I think that it's also not an exaggeration to say that it's raised the bar for artisan spirits all over the place in this country, not even just small, because I have this constant debate with people about what artisan really means. Is it small? Well, you can be small and be absolutely terrible. We've all tried small, absolutely terrible products. You can be huge and make really good things. So I think that that's a whole other discussion somewhere. But I think that the quality that you've been able to introduce into the marketplace through all of your work has risen the bar brought the bar up for everybody else. And there's a qualitative improvement all the way across the board because of what you've been able to do.
So do you think it matters that you were here? Do you think it matters that you were making eau de vie in Northern California?
It mattered to me most, and as always with these things, I probably wasn't the first one to think about these things. There was actually the California Pear Association had done a study on the feasibility, and they decided it wasn't possible to do.
It is true. It's not possible.
For whatever reason, and they probably had a good reason, which was commercial. But it's also true that I started in January of 1982. In 1980, the federal laws governing the alcohol production changed to, for the first time, really make it possible after the repeal of prohibition for a small distiller to exist. Before that, you had to pay the taxes at the end of the day. You had to have an agent present, basically supply a office for them, pay their salary and whatever. After the first months, he'd be out of business as a small guy. So it really promoted only the big guys. And that was changed for the benefit of the big producers. It wouldn't have been changed for the small producers. Sometimes the timing is just right for my intention, and I could do it. And I was the first one, and they gave me a hard time. The ATF people came to my little wooden shack in Emeryville and said, "Where's your bottling line?" Well, you know, little did they know I had a two-spout hand filler. And they were then asking, despite they could see I didn't really have room for that, where my wooden barrels were. And now eau de vie is generally not aged in wood, so you don't need that. And they couldn't understand that that was brandy. So there were all kind of these things. But the time was right for something new to come in. And I was just there.
Yeah.
I think there was also a zeitgeist here in the Bay Area. And if you look at what was going on in the food scene and the coffee scene and the beer scene, people were ripe for that sort of change. And the approach that you're taking with, oh, hello.
Something is coming around.
Cocktails.
I'm sorry.
Here's one thing I want to say about this. This is, I believe.
Yes, it is.
An example of how a digestive can be applied to a cocktail. Because we only get this up here. You probably won't be able to get the same thing.
We can describe it to you, though.
You already have it. Well, then, cheers to the pear martini.
Yeah, cheers. Cheers. What's in it? My finger. So this is pear eau de vie and straight vodka, lime juice, and a little bit of simple syrup just to take the edge off the lime juice. And this is your... So we're going to be trying over the course of this evening three different cocktails that represent three separate decades. This is the beginning. This is pear eau de vie. This is where everything started. And we're going to try and tell a story through three different cocktails, but every single thing that we make, everything that Jorg has made and everything that we continue to make, every single one of them tells its own story. So I think it's important to be able to illustrate a story as we go along with these cocktails. What's great about this one is that it takes that pear eau de vie and reintroduces a couple of the things that fermentation and distillation take away, and that's the sweetness and the acidity. So the lime juice works in there really, really nicely to be able to bring back that acidity and then the sweetness from the simple syrup.
I don't know what FCC regulations are about drinking on air. So I think this is...
We're not actually drinking.
We're pretending to. Just for clarity. We should probably get to the point of the old days when, after Lance brings in his bottle of unoffensive liquor.
It was true whiskey.
It was what?
True whiskey.
Yeah.
So, it was good.
So then what happened?
Yeah, everything fell apart at that point. All hell broke loose. Yeah, I mean, at that point, Jorg had been doing and continued to do grappas for a number of different wineries. We were really fortunate at that point in time to be right next door to Rosenblum Cellars, and we got to do a lot of work with them, made some beautiful grappa from their pomace. And in addition to that, when I came in, I told Jorg, I want to make whiskey. And it was at that point that Jorg said, great, go distill those cherries. Now go distill those raspberries. Go distill those pears, in a very Mr. Miyagi sort of experience where I'm waxing his car to learn how to do these karate moves. And I just thought he was being a jerk. But it turns out this is part of Jorg's brilliance. He's a really good teacher. And what he was doing was teaching me, I think it was intentional, teaching me to really appreciate distillation. And eau de vie distillation is the way to really appreciate the craft and the art of distillation. So learning about those things, when the time came to make a whiskey, he said, okay, now we're going to make a whiskey, and it's got to be our own. And again, that's one of the things that I think is a really important operating tenet for us at St. George Spirits, is that a lot of people jump into a category to make something just because the category's there and they want to make money in it. The only way that they end up differentiating themselves from anybody else in the crowd is through the way they market. We want to have something new and unique to say, and that's part of Jorg's philosophy. And so, and it, for me, it started with the whiskey, and he said, you know, we have to have something new and unique to say. So we created a very different mash bill for our single malt whiskey. Ended up making something that was more of an eau de vie of beer. And fresh off of the still, clear, unaged, it was malty, it was sweet, it was chocolatey, it was slightly smoky. And again, it's all because of the application of that eau de vie philosophy.
And it had an astonishing amount of fruitiness to it.
Yeah, it did.
That some people even commented, is that really grain distillate? So it's amazing to really bring out the qualities of the raw material. That's, to me, really the ultimate goal. And then, of course, I'm simple-minded, but I can see where the complexity of putting something in a cocktail can work beautifully if you don't lose the essence of what is in the center of it. And this is true. To me, that works on the pear.
Well, that's one of the other reasons that the time that we live in right now is such a magical and amazing time, because we've got a lot of bartenders that are working with very spirit-driven cocktails. And so the quality of the spirit really has to be there, because if it's all being driven by that spirit, if the quality's not there, it's a garbage cocktail. If the quality is there, it's phenomenal. It's really great.
I think that goes back to Bob's earlier point, just on the notion of St. George Spirits' success based on being a Bay Area business in part. And it's not only the quality of produce, the sort of wonderful bounty that we enjoy in California, but also the quality of consumer that we have locally here in the Bay Area, which has helped to develop and help us through.
So, and the quality of bartenders that we've got here. They're
so
amazing.
Just for the radio audience, that's Dave Smith speaking.
Hello.
I want people to know.
We forgot you were here.
I'm also not drinking.
As per FCC regulations.
As per FCC regulations. Yeah. Which may not even be...
They're not, but it's fun to think that they are.
Yeah,
and
we're not breaking the law.
we like to break the rules.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
But we're not.
No.
No. So how did when did the cocktail change from whiskey sours and from fairly set classic to the sort of new world of I think they're less alcohol too, yes?
Now?
Yeah.
Oh God, no.
Oh.
No,
sorry.
And actually Bob. Talk about old fashioned. And really, we've come full circle, and we're back to mostly the classic cocktails. And I think it's been something that's happening. It's an evolution that has slowly been happening over the last 10 or 12 years. more and more bartenders are going back to the old original cocktails and really embracing those. And they are they're higher alcohol cocktails. You're seeing fewer blender drinks, unless you go outside of our magic bubble here or outside of Chicago. I actually went to America last week. It was a very strange experience. The coffee is still the coffee of 30 years ago. It's an odd place. I'm happy to be back in California. I enjoyed the trip. Nothing against Virginia.
Really?
But the cocktails do tend to be more spirit focused, and so the quality of the spirit has to be much better. But I think, what do you think, 10, 12 years ago? You weren't drinking then because you were too young, but.
What's the statute of limitations again? No, but I think 10, 12 years ago is definitely part of that, and I think the vodka boom is directly responsible for that elevation of cocktails. It was things like flavored vodkas that were part of that wave that sort of has maybe crashed down a little bit now, and it's now gins and whiskeys that are really driving that conversation. But flavored vodka is directly responsible for the development and sort of the raising of the bar, if you will, pun intended.
So flavored vodka is sort of a good example of how you differentiate yourself from flavored vodkas. This is a basic,
absolutely, yeah. Because when we were looking at the interest that started to happen in the marketplace, Lance would go out on some sales trips, and we look at stuff, and I said, well, let's look at these products.
During the off-season.
It was amazing to us how limited the quality of these things were, because it was clear what the big producers would do is just take their regular vodka and get some flavoring and put it in, make a flavored vodka. Yeah, yes, absolutely. And working with fruit for 20 years at that point, we saw an opportunity for us because we could do something in that category that would follow our philosophy, which means use real fruit, infuse it, redistill it, and make a direct fruit infusion on top of it to get the mouthfeel for it. And not do the chemical way. And that was our approach. Very simple. It is a very similar approach we take to our fruit liqueurs, where we use true juice and the eau de vie. So, of course, it costs more to make it that way. But since Grey Goose and some other companies paved the way on that level, we were finally able to get into this with our way of making it. What was really interesting and rewarding at the same time for this, because we had no idea how the consumer would react to these things, if they would actually understand our concept. Because we've had many good concepts before, and especially me, and we thought they were good, and sometimes people feel differently about it. But here it was a uniform reaction, not only from the trade people who knew all the other products, but also from regular consumers that they say, gee, this is really different from what I've tasted before. And that of course is very satisfying for a small producer, because we had no chance against the big guys, but to do what we do.
There's a clarity in everything you do. I mean, that to me is sort of like the most, you know, the standard that I think I get from your spirits is this very focused, clear essence that I don't find in other spirits.
I think that goes back to York's palate. He's the maestro and sort of set the tone and the pace of spirits here. But ultimately, it came down to, even in the world of vodka, as the story goes, Lance and New York were sitting around saying, I don't like vodka. That's where they started with making a vodka. They made something for themselves. They made something that they wanted to drink. And if other people, I think no one was more surprised that other people wanted to drink what they wanted to drink than they were.
There are more fun stories here that start with "I don't like blank," and you can apply that to a number of different categories. And we've learned to say, "I haven't found a blank that I like yet," and then we set about to starting to work on one. So
there's a lot of fun stories that start here with "I dare you to make this because I don't think you're that foolish."
Yeah.
And
so there was nobody thinks we're not that foolish.
Not
there was a time when you're on the front page, I think, of probably every newspaper, with long lines, people trying to buy absinthe from you on some
talk day. About foolish.
Pardon me?
Talk about foolish.
Yeah. So what?
Thanks.
What was? How did that happen?
That was an accident. So. Give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish, he eats for life.
Yeah.
Give a man a bottle, he drinks for a day. Give a man a still, he wastes an entire lifetime. I showed up here, we had stills. I heard all about absinthe, what it was all about. Had never tried it. Al Gore had yet to create the internet, he had created it, but it hadn't really caught on the way it has now. I couldn't go on the internet and buy a bottle of absinthe. The internet was really more of a curiosity at that point. I was a distiller, so I didn't have enough money to actually travel to Europe, and at that time. But I was intrigued about absinthe, and I thought, well, you know, we've got a still. I might as well make this stuff. It was against the law to sell it. It wasn't against the law to make it. So we started playing around with it. Found a recipe in Scientific American magazine.
Cool. What year?
It was a 70s issue. It really took some back searching. But tried that out, realized that there were some serious misunderstandings that I had about some of the terminology. The first batch was so bitter, it was completely undrinkable. I'm trying to remember which of your friends ended up having that. Jim and Sylvia, did you guys have that stuff? Did we force that on you? Yeah.
They did.
It was awful, wasn't it? So by the time we all finished drinking this completely undrinkable stuff, I realized what was wrong and corrected it, and every batch got better and better. And then when we found out that the law was changed that allowed absinthe to actually be sold, we had a great recipe, and we knew how to make it. And we were able to be the first domestic company to release it. Had a great line out front. My high school English teacher, Mr. Fisher, was in line. And I actually snuck him in, got him out of the line, because he actually passed me in high school English, which is... It's amazing that he did that. That stuff actually, it did pretty well for a little while. And it's doing well again. It's a great product. It's a misunderstood product. It's funny, all the things that we're talking about up here, we could probably have like a 6-hour discussion. I think maybe after this is done, once the tape stops rolling, you guys should all come over to our house for a sleepover. And we'll all talk. We'll open up some bottles, and you guys lay down, and we'll tell you bedtime stories about all these things. So, okay.
It's a deal.
What are we not drinking here?
Now we're into the second decade, which is probably good. We probably only have like 20 or 25 minutes left. We're in the second decade, and this is our single malt whiskey. So this is an important place to talk about the third generation of the distillery. I showed up to the distillery. I learned about distillation from Jorg. I applied the things that I knew about brewing to be able to make a whiskey. Started some momentum going into barrels. The whiskey was good, but just like the tradition of my adopted father, I beat my head against the wall trying to convince people about what this stuff was. It's not scotch. It's not bourbon. What the hell is it? Why do I want to drink it? It's only 3 years old. What? I don't want to taste this. People weren't that interested in it, and it took a long time for people to get interested in it. People slowly warmed up to it. Right around the time they started warming up to it, Dave started actually... we always talk about distillers being inherently lazy. Jorg wasn't, but I am. Dave definitely is. I passed the buck on to Dave about being able to put the whiskeys together that go into our bottlings. Dave took very, very serious time and a lot of responsibility towards going through all the barrels that we had. You have to understand, there's a lot of work involved in going through literally hundreds of barrels of whiskey and tasting each one of them. And Dave did that. He threw himself on that grenade. So you may not really think that's a lot of work, but it's a bear to do that. And your palate is going to fatigue very quickly, and so is your nose. Dave took a lot of time to do that, and then, even better, was able to take each of those component parts and assemble better and better whiskeys. Every time we would bottle another batch, it got better and better and better. And it's Dave and a friend of the distillery named Anthony Rosario, who's come in and helped out. Big shout out to Anthony Rosario. They're both a couple of whiskey superstars. These guys really know what they're doing. And they take the barrels that we've made and that Dave has made now as well and put those together to make really, really stellar whiskeys. As a matter of fact, the 30-year anniversary, I don't know if it's appropriate time to talk about it, but we've got a 30-year anniversary whiskey that we did this year, and it's sort of pulling all the traditions together. It's some of our old whiskey that Dave has blended together, and then we put into a barrel that had some of Jorg's Perro de Vie in a barrel. And so it's got a light pear finish to it. It's really lovely. And it's Dave and Anthony's responsibility for that. It's been getting really great reviews. So
just how do you blend whiskey?
Carefully.
Like are you looking for characteristics in each one and saying, oh, that might be cool with that? Or
yeah, and earlier in the night, Lance alluded to, in the pre-program, Lance alluded to the idea of distillation sort of as looking at different colors sort of fractured through a prism. And I'd say that one of the lessons that I learned from Lance and Jorg, when I first came here, I begged to just be a fly on the wall, let me be in the room, and I'll do all the grunt work, while Lance and Jorg were blending this single malt whiskey, which I was just learning about for what we did here at St. George Spirits. And I was stunned. I was absolutely floored by the process and how challenging it appeared. It was terribly illogical. It was this weird sort of element where you've got one smoky barrel of whiskey, and I'm trying to make a 14-barrel blend, and I want to get it more smoky, so I put another smoky barrel into that blend. And now the resulting blend is less smoky than the previous version of it, and 1 + 1 = -3, and what the hell just happened? Ultimately, though,
Do you ever find out what happened? I mean, is there like...
What's today?
Did logic prevail, or it's just a bit...
I think it starts to come down to experience. It comes down to spending time with those barrels and looking at each of those barrels as their own entity. And kind of going back to that metaphor of color, each of these barrels, some of these barrels are a brilliant blue or a brilliant version of orange, and are appropriate if you know the picture that you're trying to paint. Those barrels are useful in blending. At other times, you find barrels that are not a perfect color. In fact, they're actually a picture unto themselves, and you have to recognize those barrels. And the best job that you have as a distiller is to act as a caretaker for that barrel and to step back and to say, the best thing I can do for this is to set it aside, to let it be on its own, because it's a perfect picture unto itself. This could be a sort of a single barrel type of bottling. Other times, these barrels are individual components that hopefully we can blend into something that is greater than the sum of its parts. And that's all due to spending time with Lance and Jorg and seeing that standard that they laid down for the whiskey program at St. George. And ultimately, I feel very fortunate to be working in this program now at a time when our community is so much more receptive to a whiskey that doesn't fit into any definition, and to a whiskey that is not a rye, it's not a bourbon, it's not a scotch, it's not Irish, it's not Canadian, it's Californian. And this was part of what they put into play. This is, you know, they tried peated whiskeys when they were first playing around with their mash bill, their recipe for our single malt. They discovered that they could make a lovely peated whiskey, different styles of peated whiskey. And every time they did it, it tasted like someone else's work. And it always came back to this idea of thumbprint, of something that is of this place and of us, to the point of being in this World War II era hangar today that's right off the bay. That's influencing, that's part of the terroir of our single malt whiskey program. That's influencing these spirits as we speak right now, is the location of where it's at and how that changes by our own location and who we are and how we sort of approach all these different components to put them together.
I think it's an incredibly exciting space. I mean, I think that's the first.
You're absolutely right.
You just walk in. Aside from, you don't have to drink alcohol to leave here with a buzz. You can just walk through the building. And so aside from that,
can we steal that from him?
You know, just visually and just the scale of it is extraordinary. So story-wise, I think the agave story is a pretty good story. Getting into
my
that?
Microphone off? What are the FCC regulations about cussing on air?
I think it's good.
Aaron?
No, she says no.
No?
No.
You can't do it.
Okay.
Well, it goes back to one of my old infatuations with fascinating fruit, in this case, actually, plant. It goes back over 20 years ago. I was friends with a fellow who brought in Mexican folk art up here, and his wife, Rosa, was from Mexico. And we talked about tequila and mezcal, and I said, this is really very interesting. The whole culture interests me, the development that has been going on with from the very primitive manufacture to the more industrial, and I would really like to know more about this. So our plan was that he'd bring some material in from Mexico, which was possible at the time, that was before 9/11. But somehow or another, that stuff got left somewhere and it never happened. And of course, neither one of us had the money to do anything about it anyway. It was just a curiosity item. But a few years back, the old inkling for crazy tryouts.
October 2007.
Is that when it was? Oh, that's too bad. And we actually were able to do this to find to be able to import from tequila, actually from the region of tequila, 20 tons of agave. And we thought, well, this is wonderful. We can just process it here.
Your use of pronouns, like we, I find alarming, sir.
Okay, I step back. It was all my crazy idea. And, of course, I trusted also the manufacturer of our pump from Germany.
Volker,
who assured me that, of course, this pump would be able to handle the agave once it was cooked.
Yeah, no problem.
No problem. Well,
that was good.
It was very good until we actually tried that, and it didn't quite work. And I think at this point I want to hand it over to you you have a more visceral view of this. I was retreating upstairs, and I remember we had one of our machines that we used to cut up apples and stuff that's really hard.
The mangler.
And it actually seemed to work. And I was leaving the floor and going upstairs and thinking, okay, we got it. Until I heard a fierce noise of metallic clinking, followed by the stoppage of the motor, which is really loud. And I knew something was really bad down there. And what had happened was this stuff would actually cut through the stainless steel blades of our mangler. And one of the blades came off and hit the side of the... Fortunately, it didn't hit anybody. That would have killed people. So After that,
killer tequila.
Tequila. After
what
that,
do you like to call
I left it all to Lance. It was a breeze. It was
he's very creative.
He is very creative. Yeah. I said, yeah, I'm at my wits' end. It's up to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got 15 minutes. Okay. So this is going to be the speed round. So. You guys all know exactly how tequila is made. So they talk about piñas. It makes it sound very charming, like they're little pineapples. Well, they're not. This stuff showed up, and it's 40,000 pounds, and they're really more like tortugas. They're like these sea turtles that weigh about 80 pounds apiece, and because of the fact that they all showed up in this refrigerated truck, they're stacked in there. So we had to climb in and heave them all out. They're all slimy and slippery and sticky. We throw them all out onto this tarp on the floor, and then when we realize we can't just throw them wholesale into the pump and have the pump move them, we realize we need to chop them somehow. So here we are in a distillery, about four guys with machetes and chainsaws, going at these tortugas, trying to chop them up to get them to a reasonable size to go into the pump, thinking that if we reduce them in size, the pump's going to handle them just fine. The pump still makes the vroom, 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 vroom sound. That means it's not doing anything. And the chainsaws were ruined within less than a minute because the fiber in an agave piña is about this long. If you look at an agave piña with a real critical eye, you're going to find out that it's like a ship's mooring line that's been soaked in honey for a year, only maybe a little tougher. And so the goal is to get through this fiber, and the fiber is all wrapping around the rotating equipment that we've got. So then we did, as Jorg was saying, start throwing it into the mangler. The mangler started throwing teeth out of the top. The top is where you throw stuff in. You throw the stuff in by being over the top, where the teeth are coming out. This does not agree. This doesn't work well. So that's when York said, well, we should try something else. And I thought about saying we should just try drinking tequila that's made in Mexico by people who know what they're doing. And this all comes back to being Eau de Vie distillers, and the whole goal here is to use everything. It's the Chris Cosentino worldview of making a tequila. We're trying to use the whole fruit. And that's the thing that's stymieing us. So we call up and we get a tree chipper. We're going to go Fargo on this stuff. So we bring the tree chipper in and we set up the hopper from the tree chipper to go into our pump. We start throwing these things in there. And within about 10 minutes, it's pretty clear we're not getting our deposit back on this tree chipper that we rented. And that's when I went upstairs to talk to Jorg and said, you know, this isn't going to happen. And York said, oh, you know, I know how you feel. This is terrible. You really should try harder. And since I can't cuss on the radio, I'm going to say that what I said was, okay. And I went on the internet, because at this point the internet's actually good, and it's 2007, October. Found a place in South San Francisco that sold industrial food processing equipment. Went out there, brought a bag of agave, threw it on this guy's desk, said, what would you do? And he sits there, he looks at it, he thinks, he says, follow me. Follow him out into the yard, and he brings me to this piece of equipment. It's an industrial dog food mill, and it's used for taking frozen sides of beef and extruding it into dog kibble. And I thought, you know, if anything's going to work, it's going to be that. And long story short, all it did was soften the stuff up enough that we could borrow a whole bunch of Rosenblum's macro bins. I think we had 80 macro bins strewn across the floor in here with this stuff fermenting in these bins. The top half was going all aldehydic and volatile acidity. It was like a big batch of vinegar. That all had to be thrown out. Everything else had to be loaded manually into the stills. When it was done, we opened the drain for the stills, and a slight trickle comes out. And it's because the stills had fur balls caught in their throat. These big devilish furballs. And what we had to do was reach into the stills with pitchforks and haul these things out, boiling hot, and dump them out to be able to refill the stills. It was the most painful, most horrible thing since quince. we don't have time to talk about that tonight. Not on the radio. We'll talk about it later because there will be cussing. But it was a miserable thing. But the plus side was, at the end of it, we had 477 gallons of really good tequila.
I have to actually tell you.
That was all your idea.
When we actually tasted the resulting agave spirit, because we can't call it tequila, a little part of me died. A little part of me absolutely died because it was actually very good.
You didn't want to have to go through that again.
Absolutely not. The best news about finishing that project was that we will never ever do this again, and the resulting spirit was genuinely really wonderful and
so
kind of stunning.
Do you think we should do it again?
Well,
yeah, we're going to do it again.
Come back on Tuesday.
We're going to be better prepared this time. Oh, yeah. But, you know, the quality that got me into this still kind of persists. Yeah. So it's not easy to take defeat like that.
Yeah.
I think we want to do it 100% our way and make our imprint on what we want to do with
again.
It. I'm only in the background at this point. I'm not even upstairs. So I'm on the phone. How is it going? Well, they never told us in Mexico that these fibers, as we call them politely, they use them to make shoes out of them. That just gives you an idea of the challenge that we had, but we're prepared this time, I think.
So in Mexico, they extract the juice somehow, and they don't do whole fruit.
In all tequila operations, they extract the juice with roller mills and water, and there's certain aspects of that process that I don't find is very good. And what Lance was elaborating before, when we make eau de vie, you can make it from juice, so you get a certain amount of the picture of the fruit, but if you have the solids, you get a fuller picture. And, of course, the solids where the pain is, but sometimes where the pain is where the essence is.
There's a lot of essence in agave.
To the pain.
Thank you, Dave.
And this is all this distilling is all about. That's what the alchemists were looking for, the pith of life. Not that one, the surface little thingy, no, but deep down in the center.
We want to make things that pith us off.
That's the probing we're after.
So I'm just to connect this. So you want to make balsamic vinegar out of agave.
Yeah. And so I want to make balsamic vinegar out of everything.
Yeah, but what's the characteristic of agave that you think is so interesting and would be so interesting in balsamic?
There's a really interesting vegetal quality and this really interesting mint quality. And distilling this, you know, we were talking earlier about, and Dave was talking about, the prismatic effect of distillation. And what's really great about that is you can see things in individual slices that as a whole you might not be able to tease out so easily. So that mintiness that's there in the agave distillate, that's one of the things that I think would be really interesting with that. I think that cane is another one that I want to do. A balsamic with.
You got that mill.
Got that mill?
Yeah.
You can do that.
I think we have five minutes we can report to you all. So we should really talk about what's ahead. We didn't even get to the third decade, the third cocktail.
I guess you're just looking for that third cocktail, aren't you, Bob?
Well, what's coming up?
Yeah, so you guys have that third cocktail, don't you? See?
They figure we don't get it because it's never going to stop.
It's making it around there, yeah. So we got the. So what's ahead? What's ahead for St. George? Well, working with agave is one of the things that's ahead for sure.
Starting next week.
You got the truck coming up?
No, not the truck. We're still experimenting on refining our cooking method. We have special...
We're trying to build a walk-in convection oven.
Yeah. Huh. That's the first thing. That's how we start out.
Yeah.
And once we have that mastered,
it's much like your pizza
we'll work
oven,
the other pieces.
Yeah.
And it'll be an agave convection oven.
Yeah.
What's the purpose of it? Just to soften it?
Starch conversion.
Yeah.
There's a heat-related starch conversion reaction that takes place inside the agave.
It's like with any plant material, if you have a grain, you can't just put yeast on the grain and hope to ferment and get the sugar out, because it's starch, and starch is like a complex sugar that the yeast cannot break down. So you have to use the enzymes that sometimes come with the grain or with the agave as well. And to activate those, you have to bring the temperature up. They work at a certain temperature, so you have to bring it up to that temperature to break down the starch, and then you go into the fermentation. It's a little complicated, but
it's
worth it.
It's the pith.
So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Lance,
we've got a cocktail here. Do you guys have a cocktail? Excellent.
All right.
This is rosemary simple syrup, pomegranate, and the terroir gin. And I think you should speak about the terroir gin, an ode to Ellie for the world of gin.
Yeah, so I've gotten in trouble for calling my wife a gin swiller on the radio before, so I won't say that today. but mostly from my in-laws, who I think are sitting out there. But my wife has been a gin fan, and she was with a distiller who made nearly everything but gin. And eventually the time rolled around where I realized it's important to try and maintain some domestic harmony. And not that there was any lack of it. Everything's great at home, I promise you. But again, the inspiration has to come from somewhere, and I have to make something that's going to please me as well as pleasing Ellie. So I had been inspired by picking my son up at camp in the Oakland Hills. And the smell of that camp, which was really amazing. On a summer day, you get the smell of baked earth. You get the smell of the pine trees, the bay laurel, the wild fennel, which, while it's not native, has really invaded in this lovely way. All those smells commingled in a great way, and I thought this would be great to distill. And one of the things that most people don't really recognize is that distillers have this great opportunity to capture smell. Perfume making and beverage alcohol have the same roots. They're very directly tied together. And being able to bring distillation back to those roots was something that was really interesting to me. So being able to have something that emulated that gave a sense of place, was a great goal. So being able to put together a gin that smelled and tasted like the Bay Area parklands, the hills, was a fun goal. And we ended up making something that did have that smell. Now when we go hiking in the hills, we go, wow, this place smells just like gin. I love hiking here. So.
I think this is also, earlier on tonight, we had this idea of big versus small, craft versus, you know, industrial production. This is a great example of something that was solely influenced by wanting to make this small project that I think everything in the sales world that was supposed to be on this gin was this is tiny, it will never sell anywhere.
It's bizarre.
It's maybe it'll sell some in the Bay Area, but don't get your hopes up. Let's not buy too many labels, was sort of the message. And it's actually probably the best selling gin that St. George has ever produced. When it comes down to that. I mean, it's
a lot, because we produced three of them.
Yeah.
So
four or five.
Yeah. Six.
Seven. I know this game.
Final offer. Yeah. So, and other things in the future, we're going to buy some corn from you, Bob.
Yeah.
And we're going to mix that with some rye from Shasta and some barley from Chico and make an all California, all organic bourbon.
That's right.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
I think the piece that's, you know, the piece I think we haven't done enough with is, and we have very little time, is just this something about this extreme sense of quality and the rigor, the, I mean, you know, you sort of sense it in hearing what you talked about and all that, but inside of it, you know, like when you come to work and, because you do come to work, I know.
Occasionally.
Yeah. Do you have anything to say about, is there a surprise for us or some word about just the being driven by a sense of quality? And
it's, there's an infectious passion that starts with Jorg and his passion for creating the quintessential spirit. And that I think has infected not just us up on stage here, but the entire family at St. George Spirits. And that's exactly what it is as a family. And everybody who's here, everybody who works here, they work here because of the fact that there's this embrace of that philosophy. There's a love for doing things the way that it started with the very beginning with Jorg. And that's what we all carry. And there's a great sense of pride and connection to what we do.
And madness.
Yes, but a delicious madness.
It is very close to madness.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's the positive side of perfectionism that can hamper a lot of good things.
The idea of passion gets thrown around a lot, but I think the better term here is crazy. It's a slight version or very, very severe version of obsessive compulsive disorder that actually makes you very good at what you do.
Yeah. It's just another way of expressing it. It's got both sides.
So I think it's time for us to say goodnight.
Good night.
And we'll be able to have cocktails then once this is off. So let's give a big round of applause to these three. I get to do the gavel again. This meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
All right. Don't anybody go anywhere yet. Everybody reach under your seat. Almost all of you are going to be disappointed. One of you won't be, though. Anyone? Anybody find anything under your seat? On the bottom of your seat? On the seat of your seat? You got it back there? Fantastic. Guess what? So we were talking earlier about our 30th anniversary single malt.
Just put that anywhere.
My doctors told me that would drop sooner or later. this is you're the only person in the general public that has a bottle of our 30th anniversary single malt. But you have to join the Commonwealth Club. It's $5,000 to join the Commonwealth Club. Trust me, it's totally worth it. This is delicious stuff. Thank you very much. Congratulations.
My pleasure. What do you have now?
And I do want to encourage you all to look into the Commonwealth Club if you're not already members. It's a really wonderful experience in spite of what you may have seen here. There are a lot of very informative and, dare I say, thought-provoking sort of discussions that take place. Most of them not lubricated like this. And you guys are going to be very special tonight as well. Andy and her minions are passing around tastes of our 30th anniversary single malt. And again, this is the first time that anyone outside of the walls of the distillery has really tasted any of this. And it really is three generations of work in one bottle. And I want to take the moment to thank you for everything that you've done, to all of your craziness, all
here,
of your stubbornness, and all of your brilliance for getting this going and the opportunity that you've provided for all the rest of us in the following generations.
Thank you for your forgiveness.
And thank you guys for coming.